Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Eric Siegel, the chair of the club's Personal Growth Forum, and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Our speaker is Dr. Leah Weiss, who teaches compassionate leadership at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. She's a principal teacher and a founding faculty member of Stanford's Compassion Cultivation Program, which was conceived by the Dalai Lama. Her first book, How We Work, Living Your Purpose, Reclaim Your Sanity, and Embrace the Daily Grind, focuses on developing compassionate and soft skill-based leadership, while also offering research-based, practical steps towards finding a purpose at work. A lot of us, I guess, have had the experience of facing a deadline while feeling supremely uncreative. My original method for handling this situation consisted of two phases. First, I did a waltz with the candy machine, feeding it quarters while it fed me chocolate and caffeine. And then, second, I moved on to mentally beating myself up about my procrastination until I managed to panic myself into doing the work just as the sun came up. It did work, although it wasn't the most optimal solution to my deadline problems. I successfully used this method all through college and graduate school, although back then it was pizza, not chocolate. But really, it's not a great method, and I certainly wasn't being compassionate towards myself. And that's why Leah's talk tonight is going to be so useful and why I'm looking forward to it so much. She's going to show us how to sidetrack some anxiety, be much more creative, productive, and just sane, both at work and away from work. And I know that if these techniques work with stressed Stanford MBA students, they'll certainly work with us. So it's my pleasure to ask you to join me in welcoming to the Commonwealth Club of California our speaker for the evening, Leah Weiss.
So I'd like to start by asking you, which you're probably not expecting in a talk on mindfulness, but pull out your cell phone, because I want you to spend 1 minute now and type out things that are on your mind, the things that are tugging at your attention. Your body's here, but what's pulling on you? What's distracting you? So we're going to take 1 minute right now for you to do that. Type away, have at it. Don't edit yourself. Last few thoughts in these last few moments. What don't you want to forget? What's the last thing you got to capture? And now I'm going to ask you to put that cell phone away. I'm going to talk about why that exercise, which is often for many people, when we think of mindfulness, we think of getting rid of thoughts, which there's a paradoxical effect that the more we try to get rid of our thoughts, the more they come back and bring friends. So often people, when they start a mindfulness practice, draw the conclusion that they're not good at mindfulness because they're still thinking. So what I want to explore with you tonight is how might we understand mindfulness in a way that works for the fact that not only do we think, but we feel physically and we feel emotionally. But let's start from the 10,000 foot view. So one thing we know in 21st century leadership, we are moving at a faster pace than ever. Many of us, if you look at the data, we're juggling more than one FTE, more than one person's job. There's not enough hours in the day. Our to-do lists have to-do lists. And because of this, we can easily tip into a scarcity mindset where we are approaching each new task and each new moment as though there's just not enough, insufficiency. And unfortunately, what we know is this pulls out not our best side. And you see this in the data, all the way from the microaggressions on the rise to outright workplace bullying and even violence. And this happens, it makes sense, it's a cluster, these last three concepts, the busyness, the overwhelmedness, and our behavior. Also, we're working in a time where there's changing expectations about what does it mean at root to be a professional. Are we going to show up to a job interview where it feels more like an interrogation? Or is our model of being a professional something that's more integrated? Did any of you catch on the meme that came out of the BBC anchor last year who was doing an interview in his home office, and the toddler runs in, and then comes in the younger toddler and the extra saucer like slides in. And he's horrified and has this moment where he's pushing the kids and his wife runs in the room and grabs the kids out. And I think we can all recognize that feeling of when the personal and the professional collide and having to make sense of that and the overwhelm. But following on that viral video came this meme. Did any of you see this video of a woman who's replicating this scenario? And the toddler comes in, and this time she grabs the toddler, gives the toddler some milk, somehow cooks a turkey dinner under her desk, all while she's answering interview questions, calms her husband down. You don't see this in the video, in the clip I have here. Calms her husband down, who approaches in the door and is freaking out, waving a sock around, so presumably can't find its pair. Continues answering the interview questions. And then finally, diffuses a literal bomb. So this is a pretty high bar that it's setting. It's a very different integrated vision, but it also contains within it a very high bar for what does it look like to be able to field all of these different kinds of input at one time and perform in the way this woman does. It's both inspiring and, frankly, a little bit daunting for many of us. In this kind of changing pace and stress and what is my professional identity, this is bearing out in the research when you look at the data on what kind of stressors people self-report at work. Some of it has to do with more sort of tactical things like negotiating salary, but much of it actually comes down to purpose, social connection, and interpersonal dynamics. And because of this trend, what we see is that leadership itself and our conceptions of leadership need to change with it. So instead of viewing the technically competent superstar as the ultimate leader, in many cases, we're understanding that it's the emotionally intelligent, the socially intelligent superstar who is taking the win in terms of leading organizations. And you see examples of both in our world. So one of the things I try to draw out, and I want to encourage you to be thinking about, what is your mental model? What is your version of what it means for you to be a professional? Because your goals are going to need to be reverse engineered based on this model, which often we don't stop to think about. And if it's not immediately obvious to you, one way to get there is think about, who do you admire? Who are your mentors or the people you look up to, and what are the characteristics? It could be someone who's very kind of segmented and organized and puts forward a great face and composure. That would be a reasonable goal. Or it could be someone who has an ability to hold authenticity and clarity at the same time, emotional expression and rational expression. And interestingly, at the Stanford Business School where I teach, last year there was a deep dive into redefining the leadership program. And in order to do that, getting down to what are the core competencies that it takes to be a 21st century leader. And these four qualities of compassion, courage, curiosity, and humility rose to the surface. When I started teaching a course on compassionate leadership at the business school some years ago, often the response I would meet with was shock, like perplexity. That wasn't what people expected the focus to be in one of the world's top business schools. So why is this the case? It's the recognition that soft skills can and must be trained that's filtering into not only all of the top schools, the Stanfords, the Harvards, the Columbias, the Yales, the MITs, but into the workplaces themselves. So the question becomes, how? And before I get into my framework and engage with you the process, I'd like to just take a moment and tell you a little bit about how I came to this framework. So for me, the question started out as a very personal one. What does it take to be resilient? When I was an undergrad at Stanford, I was a history major. And in close succession, my father was diagnosed with the cancer that eventually took his life, and my best friend ended his life. And so I had been studying Buddhist studies and Tibetan language, but at that point, I, with my mentor, applied for undergraduate research grants and went and spent what ended up being several years in northern India, Nepal, and Tibetan refugee communities studying and more trying to immerse myself in what are the qualities of resilience that these refugees were prioritizing. And more importantly, not just what were the qualities, but how were they being trained? And so out of that experience, it quickly became apparent that the processes of meditation and the prioritization of compassion is something that could be cultivated. That captured my imagination to the extent that I spent about 10 years in and out of getting various graduate school degrees and doing 100-day and 6-month meditation retreats with the goal to synthesize these into a perspective that marries both research and practical. Presuming that most people weren't going to go out and do these long retreats, could I try to boil down a secret sauce that wouldn't lose its power? And fast forward a bunch of years, I have 3 kids, 8, 5, and 4. So to me, the question of integration has really risen to the top because I don't have the opportunity to go off for 100 days, 100 minutes. It really becomes a question of tying into, I think, the knowledge that we have about the power of mindset, the power of cultivating a perspective. And interestingly, there's a lot of research that's coming out, of course, about the meditation, and I'll talk about that a little bit. But I want to complement it with the integration and how do we think of these kinds of skills as something that we can apply. So this is the framework that I've been teaching and I wrote about in my book, A Compassionate Leadership Framework, that starts with the foundation of purpose. We need to be clear about purpose, and purpose is one of the 2 concepts I'm going to kind of dive into with you tonight. And mindfulness married with a purpose. Because if we have a strong purpose, but it's kind of ethereal and it's not connecting to where we're spending our time, it doesn't do us a whole lot of good. And then building on this, integrating the relationship with ourself in the terms of self-compassion, and building on this, building stronger relationships with others. So tonight I'm going to focus on purpose and mindfulness. And another night we can get together and talk about the rest. At core, one of the ideas that I want to suggest to you for consideration is that effective leadership honors both humanity and dollars. This is an idea the Dalai Lama's been talking about for many years, and more recently, people like Arianna Huffington, that we need to have more robust measures for what we are focusing on as individuals and organizations. But also, it's not just a theoretical kind of idea. If you look at the research, there is a strong business case for prioritizing compassionate leadership. An investment in compassion actually has tactical advantages, higher sales and profits. Why would that be? Have you ever walked into a retail experience and you're met with a highly disagreeable person? Does that make you want to shop? Right? It's such a logical explanation, yet we can forget that and forget to prioritize it as leaders and organizations. Increased performance, customer satisfaction, retention. Everyone is always talking about retention here in Silicon Valley, keeping and attracting the talent and the war for talent. Honestly, the day and age of the ping pong tables winning talent out are done. What people are looking for, what my students are passionate about, is how can I vet for a culture that actually is going to be consistent with my values and invest in me as an individual? And when you get a culture like this, what you get is increased engagement, loyalty, and all of these kind of follow-on effects that translate quite directly to the bottom line. The other thing to keep in mind is burnout is on the rise. We see this in healthcare, where it's reached pandemic proportions. Over 50% of physicians are burned out, and that ripples out and touches all of us. Over 1 million Americans have been impacted by a healthcare provider who has died by suicide. Substance abuse, all these kinds of issues that go with burnout are impacting, and maybe we're not in chronic care right now, but healthcare is something that touches all of our lives and our loved ones' lives. But the dynamics go well beyond healthcare. And what I want to suggest when we turn to this topic of purpose is that what we're suffering in one sense is a crisis of culture, but in another sense, a crisis of valuing and understanding that purpose is something that we have to do, we have to create, and we have to invest in. So in terms of the topic of burnout, it's helpful to understand what does it look like. And this is a list I put in front of you of these signs of burnout. So take a moment and look at them. Do you recognize any of them in yourself? Do you recognize any of them in your coworkers and your family? And the signs are that you have this high tolerance for stress. So actually, because you're less emotionally invested, you can tolerate more, at least for a while. Your workplace is chaotic. Experiencing the ongoing churn can lead to burnout. If you disagree with its administrative values and you're constantly frustrated and kind of bumping up against policies that frustrate you and that you're interacting with, this puts you at risk if you're playing emotional buffer. So maybe there's someone in your department that is a handful and they are in a leadership position and you're like the go-to support person. That can take its toll over time. When you don't have control over your scheduling or ongoing unrealistic deadlines that take away your sense of agency and perspective with relationships and time outside of work. And one of the big indicators is dropping just the basic self-care activities. So your coworker who used to always go work out at lunchtime, when they stop doing that over time, would be a good time to check in with them. What's going on? It might be an early sign that they're slipping in the direction of burnout. So as promised, I want to focus in for the moment on this topic of purpose. What do I mean by purpose? Well, I'm going to go with psychologist Dr. Barb Fredrickson's definition of purpose as a far-reaching, steady goal. It has to be something personally meaningful and self-transcending. And these different elements of the definition, I think, are crucial for understanding how we can meet and engage with the different facets of purpose in our own life. So it's not something I'm going to check off of my to-do list. Purpose might add up out of the activities. It has to be something personally meaningful. So it can't be taking on an organization of any type, a business or a religious organization. We have to do the translational work to make it actually map onto our values. And it also has to be bigger than us. When you have these different features of purpose, what you get is one of the most potent ingredients that leads to resilience. When you have this kind of version, it leads to positive health indicators and resilience. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But bringing us back to kind of a foundational thinker in the field of purpose, Viktor Frankl, if you haven't read Man's Search for Meaning about his experience in the concentration camps and the Holocaust, or you haven't read it in a decade or two decades, I highly recommend picking it back up. He has so many clear expositions in it about why purpose matters. And he says, those who have a why to live can bear with almost anyhow. And he's saying that in the context of the concentration camps. And for him, what he explores, it comes back down to his why is maintaining his own capacity for love and refusing to turn his back on that no matter what. What's our why? What's your why? Purpose is the most powerful sorting mechanism. It is so easy in the initial sequence of slides and ideas I shared with you about the sense of overwhelm and scarcity mindset. But if we have a clarity and purpose that causes us to sort out what rises to the most important so that we can hone our attention there. And this is, in a way, the fundamental place where purpose and mindfulness come together. A brief history, and I mean brief in about two slides. Many of the topics that I'm talking about out of positive psychology actually come from Eastern origins and often Buddhist practices specifically. This history that I'm picking by design is a Western redaction. And I'm doing that because I think that this is the redaction that has highly influenced the cultures that many of us are working in. So it's pertinent in terms of where we are. So if we look at the role of work in ancient Greece up through the Middle Ages, what we saw was that work was seen as a curse that prevented people from engaging in the sublime and worthwhile pursuits of the mind and spirit, notably lying around naked, often with grapes, and sometimes cupids. And what this led to was not so interested in going to work, thank you very much. Fast forward to the Protestant Revolution, we turn all this on its head. There's a willingness to engage with work because work is completely reframed. This idea of a calling comes forth, that work can be an expression of what we most not only value, but who we most authentically are. Work is our opportunity to enact purpose and create it rippling out into the world. So one of the researchers that I am fascinated by, Dr. Amy Rusnetsky, who teaches at the Yale School of Management, a course that's actually required by all MBA ones, and her work focuses on purpose. And she's done tremendous and fascinating research in this space. One of the frameworks she has, I want to present to you because I find it so helpful. So the fundamentalized idea is that we can have different mindsets or perspectives about work. So one is kind of this work as income. I go to a job and I get paid. It's transactional. There's no actual implicit judgment in that. There's a great dignity in providing for ourselves and our families and so on. But it's a particular focus that for someone who's in a job mindset, if they win the lottery that night, probably they're not going back to work the next day, right? There's nothing else for them there because their need financially was met. This is distinct from what I would say is kind of the most prominent perspective in my MBA students writ large. Maybe mine skew more towards the next category, but I think generally speaking, this is a normative perspective. We think in terms of a career. It's a stepping stone mentality. What am I learning in this position that I can segue into the next opportunity? What am I learning? Who am I connecting with? What am I building on my CV that I can refer back to? Which is distinct, again, from this idea of a calling. Fulfillment from the work itself. Work making the world a better place, or making me a better person by engaging with it. So this framework, I think, is helpful in several ways. One, I talk to my students about if you're in one mindset, let's say you're fortunate enough to kind of be in a calling mindset, but you're trying to engage with someone at the workplace and manage them, and it's a job for them. You're going to be speaking very different languages, right? And you can see a mismatch that could happen in any of these. It's useful not only for a management tool, I think it's useful for self-reflection. And I don't view it that we are just stuck in one category or the other. If I'm honest and I look at my week, there's examples of being in each of these different perspectives with respect to my work, right? Sometimes it's like, here's the stuff I got to get through because I got to get through it to get to the good stuff. And I kind of catch myself. That can be a signal that this is a time to embroider in a perspective on my big why. And I'll talk more about that. So just knowing where we are then gives us an opportunity. Again, this dovetails with the mindfulness we'll be talking about in a few minutes. So coming back to this topic of purpose, this is something that we as humans have been discussing for thousands of years. So one version of purpose is this idea of eudaimonia. And it's a sense of living my life in a deeply satisfying way. It's a purpose-driven, service-driven often ethos. It's giving back in order to experience a certain kind of pleasure and reward. Then there's the hedonic perspective. Do you remember this word, hedonistic, which is a little bit more woven in with our daily language, right? It's looking for gratification, a positive affect. So I want to share with you a seminal study that gives you, I think, an interesting line of sight into the research on purpose. So this is Barb Fredrickson, whose definition of purpose I started out with in this section, partnering with Steve Cole. Both of them are Stanford-trained research psychologists. Steve is at UCLA and is a genomics professor. Barb Fredrickson is a pioneer in the field of positive psychology. So what they did was join together in a study that combines both her expertise of survey research and his of pooling what he calls the opinion of the human genome through a blood draw. What they did was look at a group going into the process. You would all be sorted. So let's say in this room, you were entering into this study. So everybody on one side of the room, you are the eudaimonic. So when you're done, you've been doing meaningful work all day. You're at the Commonwealth Club tonight, bettering yourself so you can better the world. And when you're done with this, you're going to go work on one last service project before you go to sleep tonight. You guys are the hedonists. You roll in on your motorcycles, you're headed to the bar after this, your day-to-day kind of reward system is around what is my next vacation or the next great meal, you get the point. So you're pre-sorted into these groups. First step is you all take surveys because we want to understand who's happier in some fundamental way. Well, it turns out, based on survey, you're equally happy. No real difference. And interestingly, the way they get to happiness, it feels like a very typical academic approach. It's how not depressed are you equates for how happy are you. Yes, because we love the double negative. But interestingly, then comes Steve's side of the study. And when he looks at the analysis of your blood profile, your genomic expression, what he sees at the molecular level is there's a huge difference. This group, the eudaimonic group, you have lower inflammation, higher antivirals. There's a particular sequence that he studies that is associated, he calls it the molecular soup of death. When it reaches, it's kind of the precursor for cancer, heart disease, like the type of things that are most likely to eventually take our lives. So this side of the room, you're doing great. This side, I hate to break it to you, higher inflammation, lower antivirals, you're much more likely to get the flu. And when you get it, you're going to stay sick longer, and your CTRA sequence that's predictive of really negative health outcomes, molecular soup of death, looking bad. So that's fascinating, the upshot of this, that there's such a disparity between self-report. You were all equally not depressed, but your biology looked profoundly different. And when I started encountering this work and spending time with Steve, who was directing research where I was working at Hope Lab, one of the Omidyar nonprofits, I was fascinated because I had never heard this idea that actually purpose impacts our health. One of my graduate degrees is in theology. Meaning and purpose are core to my heart and what I believe is important, but actually that it's a health indicator blew my mind. I was like, why has there been no news campaign about this? Someone has to tell the world. Because what that then implies is we need to take purpose much more seriously, not just leave it to chance. And I'm not going to read through all of the benefits because there are so many, but eudaimonic well-being has an impact on our salivary cortisol, our stress levels, our inflammation, on our hemoglobin, cholesterol, how we sleep, all kinds of things. I already mentioned that we have these antibodies and antivirals. And if you scroll down in this list that I'm presenting to you, greater glycemic control. And then finally, this last bullet of the lower risk of mortality, disability, and Alzheimer's disease. And may I remind you, this is all related to your sense of purpose. So again, like these are very diverse systems within our bodies that are impacted by whether we have purpose or not. Which begs the question, how do we go about getting more purpose, right? Like all of this is interesting, but not particularly helpful if we can't turn the dial on our sense of purpose and impact it.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
So one kind of common metaphor for purpose is the idea of the North Star, and Bill George has been doing wonderful work for a long time at Harvard Business School using this metaphor. I had a really interesting experience a few years ago where we were talking about the North Star metaphor in my business school class, and a young woman from Nairobi who had started an incredible venture, social impact adventure using technology, raised her hand and she said, you know, I get it. Of course, I understand the metaphor. This is an intelligent woman. But she said, it doesn't resonate with my life experience where I feel like there's periods of time where I know which direction I'm going and then events shift and I'm not sure where I am in all of this. Is it leading? Is this just a block in the right direction or am I headed the wrong direction? So she got me really questioning this fundamental metaphor. And soon after, I had another student who pulled me aside because I was asking these questions. What kinds of metaphors resonate with you? So this is a mid-career student who's from a military family, and he was an officer in the military, had gone to West Point, was at Stanford for a one-year program. And he told me that he had been raised, his father was a general of the Army Corps of Engineers, and from their earliest ages, they would do puzzles when they're young, the big kind of chunky puzzles that my 4 and 5 year old are struggling with at home right now, you know, 8 pieces and they're huge. They're like the size of your head. And as they get older and older, the puzzles that they're doing are more complicated. And before they leave for West Point, they do a puzzle with no box top. He throws away the box top. And now, and you know, me as a teenager, I'd been like, nope, I'm not doing this exercise. They were a much more disciplined family, as you might imagine, than many others would be. So they actually completed this exercise and had a conversation. And the point that the father really instilled was that purpose is like that puzzle box top. We need to continually refer back to it as individuals. We need to continually, as leaders, remind each other what we're building towards, understand what different contributors. It's not a race towards the North Star. It's how do my strengths and weaknesses and your strengths and weaknesses add up to the greater sum. So there's a lot of, it's in a sense, it's kind of a cliched metaphor, but it's also a really profound one. Fundamentally, in terms of this question of like, how do you get more purpose? If you look at the research, you can bucket it into two styles. One is that top-down research, mission statement style, like, let me clarify what I'm about. And that's helpful. And it gives us a sort of cognitive, rational version to work off of. Then there's also what I call these emergent values excavations, getting more clear on what I'm passionate about and what I'm not passionate about as I move through my days and weeks, and building out of that more clarity about what my greater purpose is. So basically, there's hope for the people in this room who couldn't, on the back of a napkin, write your purpose mission statement. There's processes that we can do by engaging with values and understanding our activities and how we relate with them to reverse engineer towards purpose. So what is your purpose? You know, I would encourage you to actually take that not just as a passing question, but to take that as a real challenge. Can you create your own personal mission statement? And also fundamentally, how is your time tracking towards your purpose? Because it's one thing to have a theoretical purpose, but if it's divorced from where we are spending most of our time, that creates a problem for us that we need to solve. And the first step to solving it is to understand that there's a gap. And this is where I segue precisely to the topic of mindfulness. Again, a quote from Viktor Frankl, and he's not using the term mindfulness, but I think you'll recognize some of the core ideas. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. So what is mindfulness? It's a word, especially in the Bay Area, we hear it left, right, and center, right? It's used all the time. Actually, like, I just recently came across a mindful nail salon that I was passing by. I was like, oh, I'm intrigued. I haven't made it there yet, but I'm going. So I like this most fundamental definition, the intentional use of attention as a way to start. Do you see anything in here about having your eyes closed, about meditating even? There's nothing about this definition that's incompatible with any activity that we might be doing. I'll talk more about that. There's another definition that I think adds an important element. We set our intentions, marry it with our attention, and when we see a divergence in our attention, we meet that with an attitude of curiosity. Or often in the literature, you see the term non-judgment. So we get better and better to not reacting to our reactions and creating more of this loop of churn. Out of mindfulness practice, what we develop is this metacognition, our awareness and understanding of our own mental processes, or a related term, meta-awareness, being aware of what we're aware of, which also includes emotional and somatic content. Mindfulness is big business, especially in this area. And last year, it was a $1.1 billion industry. That's right, mindfulness in corporate America and globally. This includes, you know, the meditation rooms that are at some of our well-known tech companies in the area, as well as mindfulness programs that are, you know, being done with leaders in person and apps that companies are licensing for their employees. So it's a broad bucket. But that's the number we're looking at, and it was anticipated to rise. We don't yet have the figures from 2018, but they were projected to go up. Some of the biological markers that are being used in mindfulness research, to give you a sense of how our researchers trying to understand the impact. Gene expression of the type I mentioned before. Neural networking, how our brains and fMRI machines capture the changes in where the gray matter is in our brains and the connectivity between the neural networks. Telomere length, the cutting edge research is happening here at UCSF in terms of understanding longer telomeres are associated with longevity, shorter with its opposite. So if you've seen kind of the sensationalistic headlines about meditation as the wellspring for infinite life, it's coming back to this kind of research. Vagal tones, the vagus nerve that runs through the body. If you ask Dr. Keltner of the Greater Good Science Center, he will talk about this being one of the places where mindfulness and compassion registers in the body, and heart rate variability, all kinds of other biological markers. Just to give you a sense, like, this is not anymore in the phase of before you take an 8-week mindfulness class, we ask you, how mindful are you? And at the end, we say, now, how mindful are you? We're well in a different place from that. Hopefully, you're more mindful after 8 weeks of 2-hour sessions each week, right? Ideally, we would answer that question, but are we really? So some of the kinds of research you see are so interesting. Studies designed that look at participants who don't know each other, but all just completed a mindfulness training, are put into a waiting room, and there's not enough chairs, and in comes a person on crutches who's clearly in physical pain. Are the mindfulness graduates more likely to give up their chair than control group? Yes, they are, interestingly. So there's a key piece here, and when we move into the compassion part, which we won't really focus on tonight, this is why I said mindfulness is a foundation. If we don't notice the suffering, there's no hope of responding to it. So some of the competencies that you see, if you look across the research enhanced by mindfulness, include things like attention regulation or focus. It supports us in behavior change, both getting rid of unwanted behaviors and creating wanted behaviors. Emotion regulation, which I'll talk a little bit more about. Our ability to work with stress. Also, the open focus meditations impact our ability to be creative and have connective kinds of thinking. It helps us in pain response. Some of the earliest research was working with people who were maxed out on their pain meds and looking at how does mindfulness practice or does it impact their subjective experience of pain? Spoiler alert, it does. And decades later, that's why this is a common chronic pain offering. It supports our ability for all these kind of emotional intelligence competencies, listening, negotiating with others, empathic accuracy, our ability to understand what another person is feeling and understand it correctly. Social skills and communication, all enhanced. So if you want to fit in the biggest sort of perspective, how does mindfulness impact our body? One of the schema is to look at our physical experience as including three elements. Drive, the motivation we're moving towards, the things we want to get and achieve. Threat, the impulse towards safety. And then there's a soothing system where we manage our distress, where we downregulate. This gives us the capacity to sleep, one of the things that we're struggling with in epidemic proportions, people relying on sleep medication because we can't downregulate, we can't rest, right? We know how to do drive. Some of us are stuck in threat, but how do we self-soothe? We have to relearn that. Mindfulness improves all the aspects of emotional intelligence, self-awareness, self-management, so I can know what I'm feeling, but what am I doing with that? Awareness of what's going on in the people around me and how I'm negotiating with that, relationship management. And it comes back, I think, this topic of mindfulness at work and dealing with our stress comes back to this core question I asked earlier. What is your model for what does it mean to be professional at work? Does being professional require suppression? If our model is purely one of composure, and we don't include in that an opportunity for some sort of effective and authentic expression of emotionality, then we will have a very different idea about how to manage emotions. So one of the things, if you look at the research on the intersection of emotion regulation, how do we deal with difficult feelings and the interventions with mindfulness, we have to realize that emotions contain critical information. We have to understand that the more aware we are of what our patterns of emotion are, not just cognitively, but also physically, because emotions live in the body. It helps if we understand the why behind the emotions. We have developed, theorists say, the capacity for emotion because it gives us quick, automatic feedback to how we're doing in relationship to our environment. So we can take a quick sort of pulse survey of what's going on and how we're being perceived and if we're safe, if we're unsafe, what the reactions are, not by cognitively evaluating and making long lists, but the emotions give us a shorthand. From an evolutionary perspective, it's a safety issue. Saber-toothed cat on the horizon don't want to be writing pros and cons, want to have the emotional upregulation that will motivate action. So this process of emotions, if you actually break it down to its core components, perceive some sort of external stimulus. We make an automatic appraisal. We interpret that in some way, and often we're not conscious of how we're interpreting it. And then we have this physiological response that accompanies this interpretation. So this is when I say emotions live in the body. I don't mean it in like the woo-woo sense. I mean, they quite literally are reactions to our environment, are somatic reactions. So mindfulness of the body and patterns of reaction become an important resource if we want to be able to manage not just stress, but to actually, one, better to use our emotions as a resource for vital information. So three questions that our emotions are constantly asking about our environment. Is it good for me? Is it bad for me? And what am I going to do about it? It's motivating action. Emotions are about quick and decisive behavior, which is also why they can get us into a lot of trouble, right? Dr. James Gross, who's at the Stanford Psychology Department, is really a pioneer in this field of emotion regulation. And it's grown into an immense body of research. But coming back to the very basics, if you want to take away one thing about managing emotions so you can manage stress, hear this next point. Don't suppress. Don't suppress your emotions. If you suppress, this leads you to more anxiety, more depression. You are less able to think. We've all had the experience when we're emotionally upset. Are you doing your best planning or thinking? No, you have to downregulate to bring your cognitive resources back online. We're literally hijacked by the emotion. So when you suppress, it actually worsens the whole loop and gives you, it takes more cost, not just to deal with the emotions, but to deal with the energy that it takes to suppress the emotions. And it comes across, by the way, like we're typically not really fooling anyone when we're suppressing. They may not know what we're actually feeling, but they know that there's something that is awry. We have a pretty good sniff test for inauthenticity and it has a cost. So we're perceived as inauthentic. We're perceived as unrelatable. And it challenges our very ability to function or express ourselves or respond effectively. So what are our choices then if we're talking about emotions? Because, you know, this is another important through line. If you care about your work, if you're purposeful and you're engaged in what you're doing, that also means that you're going to react because you're invested, right? If you're totally disengaged and you don't care, you're not going to get upset, but that has its own set of problems as we have already established. So let's presume now we've gotten ourselves into a place where we care about what's happening. Emotions are part and parcel of that. There's clearly the option when we're experiencing strong emotion that we can act out, we can freak out. That's kind of a self-evident option, not typically the best one, and for reasons I don't have to go into, they're logical. You don't want to act out at work. Suppression is another option. We can try to stuff the feelings down. Another option is we can work on reframing, which means understanding the emotions and reinterpreting. Remember that step two when I said we are taking in data, we're automatically appraising it, and it has a physiological reaction. Well, in that step two of the interpretation or the appraising, we can jigger around with that. And when we do, that's when the mental flexibility that is a key element of adaptive response to stress and other challenging stimuli happen. And then there's this fourth option, and this comes, I don't mean this in the sort of, again, woo-woo sense. This is like directly from the emotion regulation research. Acceptance is a great strategy. Does that mean that you accept the situation, accept the, you know, if you're upset in response to a person or their behavior. No, what the acceptance means here is that you accept the fact that you are having this emotion. You're not trying to stuff it away. That would be suppression. So when you accept the fact that this emotion is happening, then we can, through training, through practice, actually have the option for what Viktor Frankl called us to do, to have this space that gives us choice in how we act and react. So I have a question for you. How often after you make some sort of mistake, and it could be real or imagined, an awkward conversation just as much as like you drop the ball on something, how long do you ruminate? How long do you worry about it afterwards? Is it done as soon as you notice it and you fix it? Do you take it home? Do you think about it the next week and the next, or every time you see that person? It's useful kind of litmus for how are we working with the emotions in response to action that we have taken. And in this case, perhaps mistaken or awkward action. So what if we obsessed about the things we appreciate about ourselves, the great actions that we've taken, the wonderful impact we've had? Does anyone here have a propensity towards this? This is like a kind of unimaginable scenario, I think, for most human beings, like obsessing about what I appreciate about myself. We have a negativity bias. We obsess about what went wrong, or what we don't like about ourselves. We skew towards a bias with respect to other people that if they look unhappy, then it must be about me. My automatic interpretations will skew much more that way. So I just raise a hypothetical question. What if we were somehow able to even change our fundamental understanding of where our mind wanders off to? Well, actually, that would be quite difficult to do, because a wandering mind, if you look at the neuroscience of it, a wandering mind is an unhappy mind. A wandering mind, it ruminates, it catastrophizes, it imagines all kinds of scenarios that are not the happy, uplifting ones. So if we understand that, that's another reason for like why we might want to cultivate this intentional use of attention. Now, often at this point in the conversation, people will object, well, I need my self-criticism. I want you all to be happy and well, but I got to where I am because I hold myself to a higher standard. Self-criticism is a critical part of that. So let's take this as an empirical question. Maybe it is. And a number of researchers have been looking at exactly this question. Is this a good motivator? Well, it turns out the self-criticism is associated with depression, with anxiety, with avoiding scenarios where we might lose our self-esteem. It makes us have unattainable standards and procrastinate and ruminate. So the critical piece here is knowing your triggers, knowing the things that set you off in a strong direction disproportionately, understanding what these patterns are that lead to the triggers, and then integration. And that's really the thought that I want to leave you with before I take your observations and questions. How might we integrate mindfulness into our everyday life at work? Well, one thing is we can understand what are the metrics that we value. Right. So I've been working on a case study in an organizational setting, asking questions of organizations in different sectors like tech and healthcare and federal government, Forest Service, to understand what are your goals, right? And how does the mindfulness programming that you're already using either meet or not meet the goals? Let's understand that. We can look in terms of organizational wide culture change efforts. We can look at how can I as a leader influence my department, and how can I as a leader influence myself and become a more self-aware and other-aware sort of exemplar role model. So we build this in all kinds of ways, from how we hire, how we promote for organizations that take this seriously. You have good meeting hygiene. You structure your feedback in a way that people are actually understanding this dynamic of self-criticism and setting it up so that you're not putting someone at the same moment that they're getting a 360 feedback about the things that everybody around them thinks they can improve. And then you're saying, okay, great. What's your action plan? That's an unrealistic setup, right? So you can change some of these processes. in those spill over into positive ways. And then actually, you know, there's questions that you can ask about what is this possible to even bring in when you fire someone. So when Jeff Weiner, the CEO of LinkedIn, came into my class last year, this was the discussion that the students had with him. And if any of you have this question, we can come back to it. So does it count is a critical question that people often ask me. So in breaks, the first number of years I was offering workshops or teaching, people would come up and say, well, does it count if I do this when I'm running? Or does it count if I do it when I'm gardening? I don't want a seated meditation practice, but I'm on board with the prospect of mindfulness. And I think when we look at the research on mindset and how that can impact our experience and our physiology, we can actually confidently answer, it counts if you make it count, whatever the activity is. Picking a spot in your day where you are inserting a ritual that will remind you, or taking a ritual you already have that will remind you to return to this intentional use of attention. Revisit your purpose. Setting passwords. This is one of the hacks that my student had done. She was kind of extremely addicted to her cell phone and realized this week two of class, like when I asked her to put her cell phone away because it was a mindful leadership class. Setting up things like that force us to remember our goals. If you're already working out and taking the walk, can you bring this into what you're already doing? Can you build in a little bit of silence? Can you build in the coffee break to make it a true break? And that would mean understanding what you're preoccupied with mentally, emotionally, instead of being frustrated or like my Lyft driver did on the way over, screaming at all the traffic. You could just, here I am, I'm stuck. I could use this as a moment to remember what I really care about, my why. And always when we're with other people, there's an opportunity to be paying attention, to understanding what they're saying, what they mean by it, what's happening in them. It's a perpetual opportunity for mindfulness. So I'm curious, and I'd love to open the floor to your ideas about where are places in your day that you're seeing the bright spots, the existing practices of the intentional use of attention, or what connects you back with your purpose. Do you have any of these places? What are they? Or if you want to build a habit of it, where do you see an opportunity to do one tactical thing? Because we need to remember the tenet of behavior change. If you leave here tonight saying, I will be mindful and purposeful, you're likely to not see a lot of change. If you pick one practical thing that you're actually going to implement, then you could very quickly see some benefit. So what do you think?
Hi. Thank you for amazing presentation. Enjoy a lot. And I have a question or a proposal. Like, whenever this is said that these are the things that are going to get you be more anxious, depressed, and this and that. If you have this profile, self-criticism, and this and that. And then here you have this mindfulness life and this mindfulness practice, but what's in between? Like, what's the plan to get to become a mindfulness person or a mindfulness worker, wife, husband, brother, whatever? Like, how to get it in order not just to, I just rely on what you say and I trust you. Okay, right. I will become mindful and that's it.
Yeah, definitely don't do that. Don't just, I think the first very practical step is to take a baseline assessment of like, where is your attention going? Like, what is the state of the union internally with distraction? I think understanding the role of self-criticism, I always say the first assignment in trying to lessen self-criticism is just to like, see what kinds of things precipitate it. And then don't criticize yourself for criticizing yourself, right? So there's this idea of like the second arrow that we have habits of attention. But then when we start layering on judgment, because now we've been in this talk and I see like the actual health risk I'm under because I don't feel purposeful today, right? We don't want to go that direction. So it's tying this to behavior, to reminders, to acts. So pick, I would say, the challenge I'd put back in your court. What is one ritual that you could put in your life, or it could be a ritual you're already doing, your 10 a.m. coffee break, that becomes your reminder to just, it won't last all day long, but it'll be an opportunity to say, what's happening with me mentally, physically, emotionally right now? And that would be a really good starting point if you started doing that every day at 10 a.m., and better yet, do it again at 11 and 12. You know, so I think starting with frequent check-ins is a first really great step and a measurable action. So maybe that's a 1 minute of meditation, or maybe that's learning how to integrate and the intentional use of attention in exercise you're already doing. Unplug, you know, and actually like rest your attention in your physical sensations of doing the exercise. That would be a mindfulness practice. Yeah, great question.
So how do you practice mindfulness in an environment where everyone else seemingly is not being mindful?
Culture impacts us, and we are social creatures. So there's definitely when the rewards go towards being harried and the messaging reinforces emotional imbalance and attentional imbalance, that impacts us. But at the end of the day, where we put our attention, we always have agency over. So I would start by like kind of reclaiming that agency. It is my attention. Other people can act in all sorts of ways, but then maybe I would focus on the emotion regulation piece first and just like understanding habits of emotional reactivity to these insensitive people that you're surrounded by. That's step one, not leaving it there. And it may ultimately be there's further steps. People will often ask, like, if I'm in a culture that is toxic, you don't want to end up using mindfulness to keep you going in an environment that is not a fit for you. But a first step can be to figure out what's going on for you, because you don't want to do like the kind of dating thing where you hop from one situation to the other and the common denominator is actually ourself, not the other person or the other organization. So starting there is never a bad call, but it may actually be the first of more steps.
Okay, so to answer your question, because I think you wanted some of the audience members to start putting out our ideas of mindfulness, one thing I'm trying to do is reclaim my morning for myself, because I have a lot of team members on the East Coast, and I started realizing that their frantic need to be productive in the morning was taking my mornings away. So I turned off my Outlook notifications and started trying to be more mindful when I drink coffee and remind myself that I drink coffee because I like coffee, not because I'm trying to wake myself up faster so I can work sooner. So that's what I'm trying to do right now. My question is a little bit along the lines of the last question. I think it's probably something a lot of us who are here are like, great, we're learning about how to be more mindful, but what we really need is our boss to be here as well. And so I'm curious about your research with some of the organizations that you're studying and what you've seen that really kind of moves the needle. Is it organizations going out and buying, you know, various software products and making them available to their employees? Is it employees taking it upon themselves to go to these types of trainings that their company is offering? Is it teams, you know, investing for, you know, for their smaller groups and then trying to kind of expand outside? Like, what really moves the needle in terms of helping individuals and kind of changing culture of a company to be more mindful and aware of how we each impact each other?
I mean, I think a starting point is always the art of the possible and understanding where we fit in within the bigger system, right? So like if we all have influence in some domains. We are all leaders no matter where we are in the org chart because we have the power to influence. I think emotional dysregulation gets to be really challenging. When we're upset about the culture, then that spills over into being more unskillful behavior and feedback. I think actually the capacity, you asked the question about, you know, people's boss and how to impact them. I think the capacity for managing up at its core is like first working with frustrations to the point where you know you're not going to be reactive in a way that will harm you. And then experimenting with communication, with really like being more candid. And I think that mindfulness is a great support for candor, but also keeping an awareness as of if we're getting really upset, we probably want to not be like just saying whatever comes to mind, but like sorting through where we are in the whole. So if we're on a team, we always have the opportunity to kind of influence the way that we approach our work, asks that we're making, if we have the opportunity to run some meetings or ask the questions we're asking of the people who are running the meetings. So I think looking for where your unique opportunities for influence lie, and then building on there. But ideally, we work from all three levels that I mentioned, culture-wide, like what are the policies that we have that support a humane workplace, that, you know, what are the messages? Is it overly bureaucratic that, you know, theoretically we care about our employees, but if someone is a sick relative, the line of thought is we better not help them because we can't scale that response. So actually, we're kind of theoretically about compassion, but practically speaking, we're not, because we don't do anything to help that person when their parent's sick, which, by the way, that will impact that person's loyalty. Maybe not that day when they're in the time of distress, but eventually they'll leave. And by the way, it influences everyone around them who's seeing, like, hold up. There's no support for this person who's been here for 5 years or 10 years and missed family events and put their blood, sweat, and tears in this organization. This is how they're being responded to, right? So the culture level is crucial in understanding the sort of team dynamic, group dynamic level, and not skipping over the individual work, because there's nothing worse than someone who's like kind of perceived to be upset and on a mission. Like, they won't have the kind of influence that they would if they were perceived to be, like, you know, coherent and reasonable while they're making recommendations. So it's a tall order for sure. But I think it's, I'm not one to just say, oh, breathe your way into organizational change. That's really simplistic. But I do think thinking in terms of these three levels is a helpful way to analyze any situation. And also, like, where do we impact? If you're a CEO of a company or you're in the C-suite, you're going to have the ability to make some changes whenever you decide to that will impact a broader number of people. But even if you don't have that agency, you can still work on these other dimensions. So you're not, like, without options.
So I have a quick question about, I guess, in a nutshell, imposter syndrome, where I'm originally from the Midwest, and I 7-8 years ago, I went to college at UC Berkeley, and then I have been in the tech industry and here for the last 3 years. In the Midwest, the attitude about life was felt in those two mindsets about work as income, like transactional, and also work for advancement. Here, I find it more focused on fulfillment. And I wanted to get your thoughts on how you can differentiate the purpose or the difference, balance what other people are saying is purposeful, because all these companies are saying this is the mission, this is what we're going towards, this is what you need to be doing, versus following your true North Star, your purpose for life. Where do you find balance to those two things, and how do you feel like you're achieving purpose without feeling like, you know, you should be actually achieving something else or being pushed in different directions?
So a very small, simple question, in other words. I love the there's a lot of dimensions to this. I mean, I think imposter syndrome, I like that it's an idea that we're bringing more attention to. I feel like it's more people are writing about it and trying to understand it. And one of the key elements of dissipating that, I think, is understanding how ubiquitous it is. One of the exercises I do at the business school is I have them submit ahead of time in a survey. I ask them some question about, like, when they show up to Stanford Business School, how qualified they feel to be there, and they respond. And basically what happens, long story short, is everybody in the room feels like they're the one exception and mistake that admissions made. But they presume nobody else is feeling it, and they would never say that, right? So I think this is why I'm glad we're talking about it, because I think it's much more common than we realize. It's an interesting question you're raising about keeping your own sense of purpose in relation to organizations that have really strong articulations and, like, actually strong asks of us that for our belief system, that it's not enough that we're doing excellent work, but when we are, the insinuation is we should think a certain way. I think it's a really unique moment in that there's something, you know, that we can see as an upside to a purpose-driven organization. But then I also hear people, like, kind of saying, don't I get privacy inside my own head about how I feel about the work I'm doing if I'm doing it well? You know, or maybe the purpose matters, but it doesn't translate to day-to-day life. So I think keeping in mind both the top-down, so, like, what is your mission statement for you as an individual? I'd encourage you to think about it, not just you as a professional, but, like, you as a human being, which will include other dimensions outside of work, and see where the convergence and gap is with the organization's mission. And if that process of like articulating your own mission is a little nebulous right now, then do some of the work on the bottom up, like getting really clear about your values. What are the acts within your work that are most meaningful to you? Focusing on extra role behaviors, like this idea of opting into experiences at work that might not be part of your core role, but are really meaningful. Those can really boost, you know, an hour or two of that kind of thing a week where you get to be tangentially involved in or learning from a project. That is all really purpose inducing.
I've got one question also related to purpose. Are there, and you sort of started touching on this, are there practices or exercises that you would recommend to help find ways to infuse more purpose into your career or realign your career back to a purpose that you've identified, but maybe you think is sort of drifting off course?
Yeah. There's a time to purpose challenge that I have developed that's a way that we basically take audit of our calendars and how we're spending our time, identifying gaps between purpose and like where the time's actually going, and then making sort of step-by-step experiments or planting things that are more purposeful, or we think might be, we have the hypothesis might be. So it's a step-by-step, like actually looking on, say, a Friday about the week that you have ahead that you're going to meet with on Monday. It's looking the next Friday, how did that week go? And then making some changes and maybe throwing some meetings overboard or over time changing what you're saying yes to and focusing on. And it's kind of a tactical way to bring purpose and the intentional use of attention together. So I'd recommend that one.
Okay, our gratitude to Leah Weiss for being with us today. And she'll be out signing books, and you can talk to her out in the lobby afterwards. We're also grateful to our audience here, as well as to those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 116th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.